You're listening to True Crime, True Story Network.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of True Crime, True Stories. Today, we have a very special guest in the house. And it's a guest that's interested for a number of reasons. His book is out right now, Confessions of a Former Prosecutor. It's a must read. I tell you, I had 30 students in my class read it, and they all came back with the same conclusion. Change does happen. So people, you already know what it is. You could get this episode on all your major platforms. As soon as we're done, I'm going to promote this like no other because I do believe in change. I am a recipient of change. For those of y'all that don't know my story, my name is Suave Gonzalez, your host. But I'm also a former juvenile lifer that spent 31 years in prison with a life sentence. And it was a miracle that had to take place for me to come home. But it was also change in people's hearts. It was change in the people that at one time was responsible for me going to prison. You know, it was through because of change of heart that I made it home. So this is why this guest today, Preston Chip, is so interested because if you follow his body of work as a former prosecutor, he was that person. He was that guy that when you see in your paperwork, you know you going in. You know you staying in. Because trust me, my man is that sharp with the law. But today, you know, we got him in the house and we just want to talk to you, Mr. Preston. Welcome to the show. Welcome to the show. You just don't know how much we want to hear from you and learn from you. So, Mr. Preston, I'm going to get right to it. What does it feel like going from a prosecutor to an advocate?
Well, thank you so much, Suave. It's a pleasure and an honor to be talking to you, and especially on your show. You know, I would say going from being a prosecutor to now being an advocate for criminal legal reform and changes in the law that will result in people coming home, getting second chances at life outside prison. It's been dramatic. It's been humbling. You know, I think anytime you are talking about someone or some attitude that you thought was right, and then you came to a clearer understanding and you were kind of forced to admit, if you're going to hang on to any integrity at all, you're forced to admit that you were wrong. And then you go about trying to sort of atone for that wrongness. I think, you know, our faith traditions call it repentance. It's hard, you know, it's hard and at times humiliating, and you can be ashamed, but at the same time, I think that repentance, conversion, changing your mind is sort of like the ultimate human seriousness. You know, I mean, if we're unwilling to change our minds, if we're unwilling to turn around when we find out we're going in the wrong direction, then I don't know how much hope there is for us. You know, that's part of the beauty of being a human, is recognizing that we're not perfect. We don't have all the answers. And that as we grow and learn and are exposed to new people and ideas, that it can change us and make us better, make us more who we were, I think, meant to be in the first place. So it's been hard. Like I say, at times humiliating, but ultimately very, very life-giving.
You know, from reading your book, I get the sense that you was that one prosecutor that did the homework. And most of your response, you know, were to the point. And you lost no sleep about it. You lost no sleep. You did what you did, move on to the next case. But then it came to the point where you speak about you went to teach in a woman's prison and it changed your perspective. And that to me speak to the truth that you don't know somebody till you really meet that person, because a lot of time in the criminal justice system, prosecutors only get a file with what that person supposed to be or did, but you know nothing. You even said that yourself. You know nothing about the individuals in the cases you're prosecuting. So at what point you came to the conclusion that you say, you know what? I want to try this. I'm not going to say you had it wrong the first time, because you was doing your job. And the job of a prosecutor is to prosecute. And I respect everybody's job. But I will say, you brought a different perspective, because you was in the prosecutor's office, in the state attorney general in Tennessee's office, prosecuting cases, responding to different petitions. But then you went into the criminal justice system deeper. You went into the prison system, where I'm assuming you possibly knew I might bump into someone that I prosecuted or respond to their petition. Did you ever thought about that when you took the job going into the prison?
You know, that possibility didn't really cross my mind, that having been a prosecutor for a number of years, that once I got the opportunity to go teach college classes inside a prison, it just didn't really register as a possibility that I would have in class people, a person whose case I had worked on. I think the numbers just, you know, when there's, you know, there's 30,000 or so people locked up in Tennessee, in, you know, I don't know how many prisons we have, probably 20 or so maximum security prisons. And my class only had 15 people in it, you know, who lived at the prison. And so the idea that one of those 15 might have been somebody whose case I prosecuted, I didn't really think that was much of a possibility. But, you know, to your point, going in, it was very quick that once I was in that classroom and we had put our chairs in a circle and we all started just talking, it was amazing how quickly I became uncomfortable with the job that I was doing as a prosecutor. And I think that the system that we talk about, the criminal legal system, mass incarceration, you know, it's not an accident the way that it is. It's designed to keep people apart. You know, it's designed so that prosecutors only know about, you know, the person whose case they're working on, you know, the worst details of their life. Because if you start to get to know that person, the blinders sort of come off, and then you have the possibility of compassion and understanding and a relationship. And when you have that proximity, which is what I gained, you know, in that classroom out at the Tennessee Prison for Women, when you have that proximity, then you're much less likely to be willing to throw someone away. Even for five, it's, you know, we say like 5 years is not a long time in the prison system. You know, you did 31. 5 years is a long time. So, you know, and to think that I would not lose sleep over arguing that somebody needed to be separated from their family for 5 years, miss five Christmases, five birthdays. I think people can only do that job when they don't have that proximity to the people who are actually serving the sentences. Because when you meet them, when you look at their faces and look into their eyes and you hear about their context, their background, what they've been doing, you know, with their time, the way that they're investing in rehabilitation, their dreams, their plans for when they get out, they get to go home. It's like, you know, at least for me, I mean, I started rooting for those people. You know, I considered them friends. I think they considered me a friend. I would have been glad to have them live in my neighborhood, come to my house, eat dinner, meet my family. And so that was when I started losing sleep, because I knew that, you know, the job that I was being called on to do was foreclosing on hope and foreclosing on compassion. And that's just, that was no way for me to try to live any longer.
You know, when I hear you speak and I hear your story, it reminds me of someone in my church. It reminds me of that, because I get the feeling that you was brought up with God in your life.
And, yeah, that's right.
And I get the feeling that even to this day, you are a very, very spiritual person connected to your God, right? How did mm-hmm. that play? Did that ever play a role in the decisions when you was responding to these petitions? Was there ever a conflict with you, like, oh, I'm doing my job, but I'm also serving my God? Because you mm-hmm. come across as a very spiritual person.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, yes. I was raised very religious, very conservative Christian. And so I was taught from a very early age that your faith should touch every part of your life, you know. But even though we said that, somehow I managed to sort of learn that faith is important, but it still kind of goes in a certain compartment. You know, you have sort of that Sunday morning church experience, you know, where you sing and pray and teach about redemption and mercy and forgiveness and all those things. But that compartment didn't really intersect with Monday through Friday being a prosecutor and arguing for, you know, punishment, retribution, not mercy, not forgiveness, you know. So on the one hand, you know, on Sunday, you learn that we're forgiven and we should be forgiving. But Monday through Friday, you withhold that forgiveness. And instead, you know, you insist on retribution. And the only real explanation that I have is that the sort of flavor of Christianity in which I was raised, it really did sort of emphasize punishment. You know, of course, we sang and everything about mercy and forgiveness. We believed we were going to heaven and everything. But ultimately, you know, there was this underlying fear of punishment, you know, that we do what we do, we believe what we believe so that we can avoid punishment. And when that's sort of the bottom line for your Sunday morning, for your faith, then I think it's very easy for that to also be the guiding principle behind how you deal with, you know, violence, you know, or someone who breaks the law. Well, I mean, we default to punishment. God's going to punish, we're going to punish. So at the same time that I was kind of having this career crisis, I was also trying to kind of unlearn some things about my Christian faith and let go of this idea that the bottom line is sort of punishment unless you opt into the Jesus plan, the forgiveness plan, you know, that you know, punishment, that's not necessarily the true bottom line for the Christian faith. You know, that we're told that fear, you know, has to do with punishment, and perfect love casts out fear. And so I was trying to learn, well, what would it mean to be guided by perfect love instead of fear of punishment? And I think that's a conversation that we can have on Sunday mornings and Saturdays in our faith communities. I think it's also a really important conversation to have Monday through Friday.
Yes, and I agree with you. I think that in America politics, the Christianity flavor is always in the front, but it don't reflect in the law. It don't reflect in the policies that these politicians pass throughout the United States. They keep minority people in prison for decades and decades and decades without America do not offer some people, American justice system do not offer people mercy and compassion. Mm-hmm. And because the people that create these laws, they portray themselves as Christian, but they don't live that Christian life Mondays to Friday. Sunday, they mm-hmm. had that flavor. But to me, the most interesting thing about you is that you're from Tennessee. And those that know history, we know that the history in Tennessee towards blacks and people of color is not beautiful. And even to this day, you could drive to Tennessee, certain towns, you might have some trouble. You might have some trouble, you know. So to me, my question to you is this. Does that attitude reflect from time to time in the criminal justice system in Tennessee?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I think Tennessee, you know, is a very, very conservative state. And I don't mean to use conservative like it's some kind of a bad word. I mean, I think that there's, you know, some things that are very much deserving of being conserved, you know. But I do think in states like Tennessee and other states in the South, states, the former slave states, they tend to be very punitive. You know, I mean, these states that we call the Bible Belt, they're the only states that are mainly the states that are still holding on to the death penalty, you know. And so I think that, you know, you see in the South, in the Bible Belt, in states like Tennessee, this intersection between conservative, even kind of fundamentalist Christianity, because, you know, you can't throw a rock without hitting a church building down here. And also, you know, a very retributive, punitive spirit. And like you said, that's what the system is. You know, I mean, the system is retributive. It's about, I would say, institutionalized vengeance. That's what we do with our courts and our prisons. And then add to that racism, you know, which I know that racism exists everywhere in the country. It's not like, you know, there's just one part of the country that is plagued by racism. But I would say in the South, we've probably done less to confess and repent of that racism than anywhere else in the country. You know, I mean, it was here in Tennessee that we had two very vocal black members of the Tennessee General Assembly kicked out of the General Assembly by a bunch of white people who I think were just offended that black people would be making noise on the floor of the legislature. You know, so I think where you see these things intersecting, this, you know, this fundamentalist Christian faith, spirit of vengeance and racism, that leads to, you know, a really, really tough state to try to do, I would say, the work of real justice and reconciliation.
You know, I appreciate you saying that because I don't think a lot of people understand that racism still exists in the criminal justice system. I don't think a lot of people understand that. A lot of people are in denial, not in my state. People, even in Philadelphia, it's happening. It's happening in Philadelphia. You know, all you got to do is look around. It happens everywhere, people. But the fact that we have someone that was in the criminal justice system, I mean, and I'm not just talking about low level. For those that want to know more about Preston Shipp, look him up. Look up his body of work. It's amazing. His body of work is amazing, both as a prosecutor and as an advocate. Because as an advocate, he's just as good. He's just as good as an advocate as he was as a prosecutor. Can't take that away. And to me, what's more impressive is that you are part of this organization, CFSY, that goes around state legislators and state capitals changing the law so that juveniles, as myself, won't ever have to lose decades and decades and decades of freedom inside these prison walls. That's what's more impressive with the work that you do today. So tell me, how did you got involved with the CFSY and what brought you to that organization?
Well, yeah, I'm just thrilled and honored to be working for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. I've been with the organization now about a little over 5.5 years. And so it just has been a real blessing and gift to get to be part of this great team of people who were trying to end life without parole and other extreme sentences for kids. The way that I got into this work was a few years, three or so years after I left the Tennessee Attorney General's office, because I had in my mind I was going to be a career prosecutor. That's why I went to law school, was to be a prosecutor. So when I sort of had this this conversion experience, it was really hard. I mean, I was really walking away from my chosen career, but I ultimately quit my job with the AG's office and started, you know, occasionally would share that story, like I am with you, just what was it that brought about this change of heart and mind? And people were interested in that. I think people were interested to hear about a prosecutor who had lost faith in the system and was, you know, becoming a more and more an advocate, you know, for folks who were caged. And so I was invited to a conference in 2012 in Cincinnati to sort of share that perspective. It was an amazing experience. The Children's Defense Fund was having their annual conference, and I was on a panel with Michelle Alexander, who had just written The New Jim Crow, and that had made a huge splash. So everybody was talking about Michelle's work. Brian Stevenson was on the panel, of course, the author of Just Mercy, with the Equal Justice Initiative down in Montgomery, Alabama. And in attendance at the conference was Jody Kent Levy, who was the executive director for the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. And so Jody came up to me afterwards and said that she really would like to have me kind of share the story of sort of a recovering prosecutor, former prosecutor at the CFSY's annual conference. So I did that. I was invited back a couple of times to continue to share and kind of provide that perspective, you know, because what the CFSY is trying to do essentially is change people's minds, because all around the country, we used to sentence children to die in prison. You know, we used to sentence children to the death penalty until 2005. And that was all based on this racist myth, you know, this super predator myth that there are some kids who just can't be saved. There's some kids who are just beyond the hope of redemption. And that's all, that was always a racist lie. And so we're going around, we're trying to help other people change their minds and say, no, there's never a time. There's never a child who is beyond the hope of redemption. No child should ever be excluded from the sphere of our compassion and concern. And so Jody, I think, saw in me someone who had changed their mind about a lot of these things, and maybe I could sort of help other people do that as well. So after getting involved and coming to conferences and getting to know some of the staff and everything, finally in 2019, they asked me to come on board. Eric Alexander, who was one of the founders of the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network, he and I, both from Tennessee, we'd known each other for years. And so Eric reached out to me to see if I'd be interested in joining the team and working on legislative advocacy. And yeah, it's been great. It's been a real gift. We've had a lot of success around the country getting these bills passed, but there's a lot of work left to do.
I mean, to me, when I heard that you was coming on the team, I was like impressed, because I follow your work. I follow your work before you even left the prosecutor's office. Because one of my producers, she was working on a case up there in Tennessee. I'm not going to say the name, but your name was on that petition. So that's why I follow the work. So when I seen the name, I was like, wow. So as you going through this transformation from a prosecutor to an advocate, did you get any pushback from your former colleagues? Like, you're doing the wrong decision. What are you doing? Oh, my God, he lost his mind. He must have been going crazy. I mean, because sometimes I think the listeners need to understand that we just not talking about any prosecutor. We talk about a prosecutor that was successful at what he does. And all of a sudden, you go into this prison, you start teaching college courses, and now you have a whole different perspective. Did some of your colleagues push back on that or try to convince you like you're doing the wrong thing?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of misunderstanding. And by that, I don't mean like necessarily confusion, you know, but them just genuinely not being able to understand why somebody, especially a prosecutor, would go spend hours every week at a prison, you know, with a classroom full of folks, some of whom were serving juvenile life without parole, talking about judicial process, which is the class that I was teaching. You know, I think that prosecutors especially, but a lot of people are inclined to think, especially when somebody causes harm, commits a violent act, especially, you know, if somebody loses their life, you know, a really, really tragic case, that we tend to label those people and just assume the absolute worst about them, which again, that's how you do the job. You know, that's why you don't lose sleep at night, is because you think about this person in dehumanizing terms, you know, and think, well, they're just getting what they deserve. So I think that there was a lot of not understanding what I was doing, and especially when they saw that it was sort of affecting my ability to do my job. Not that I couldn't do my job, but like I was losing my faith in the system, you know. Yeah, I think that there was a lot of, because, you know, prosecutors, like probably judges and police officers, you know, it's really important to believe that the system works. You know, if the system doesn't work, then again, you may lose some sleep over what you're doing. And when you see one of your colleagues who's losing faith that the system is working as it should, or even starts to question the legitimacy of the goals of that system, then that does. That leads to some cognitive dissonance. So I did lose some friends. I did have people who thought that I had gone off the deep end. I think that, you know, one of my mentors, the person who invited me to that very first conference with the Children's Defense Fund, her name is Janet Wolfe. She's a Methodist minister and community organizer and has been teaching in prisons for decades. And Janet is real quick to point out the difference between charity and justice. She says that, you know, if you're operating, you know, within a paradigm of charity, you know, you're always just kind of throwing a few little bits to those poor souls, you know. It's so good. It's so good to give a little bit to a homeless person, you know. But it doesn't do anything to disturb the power imbalance, you know, and the systemic nature of injustice and oppression. When you're operating from a place of justice, which is what I started kind of catching on to the longer I was at the prison, then you want to disturb those imbalances, those inequities, those injustices. I think as long as I had just gone to the prison and just taught a college class here and there, probably nobody would have been bothered by that. What a good thing to do. It's like volunteering your time. Everybody likes to volunteer at a soup kitchen, you know? But when you start asking, well, why are these people hungry? Why don't these people have homes to go to? Why are all these people locked up for crimes they committed? They're in their 40s and they're still serving time for something they did when they were a teenager. Now you're starting to talk about, you know, injustice and systemic inequities and the racism that's baked into the system. That makes people uncomfortable.
So what does losing your faith in the system really looks like? I know you spoke about it, but what does it really look like? For the listeners, they might say, what does that look like for a prosecutor?
Let's see. I would say that losing your faith in the system, there's probably a lot of ways to talk about it, but I'll use sort of a metaphor here. Let's say that the criminal justice system is an assembly line that produces cars. And say that the prosecutor is just responsible for like tightening one bolt on that assembly line. there may be some prosecutors who sort of question how well that bolt is being tightened, right? Or they may look at what the police are doing or what a judge is doing, or, you know, and think, well, you know, we might do this part of the assembly line better. But I would say that losing faith in the system is not just looking at how well your bolt is being tightened. It's zooming out and looking at the final product and saying the car that we are producing is a piece of junk, a death trap. It is not safe. It is not reliable. And we need to shut this assembly line down right now. That, I think, is losing faith in the system. You know, it's not that we need, it's not about tinkering with it. It's not, well, we need more prosecutors who would do X, Y, and Z. Or, well, we need to change this law, and that will produce a better result. Losing faith in the system is saying, you know what? Our response to harm and to people breaking the law, throwing people away, intentionally causing people to suffer, taking people away from their families, hurting their communities in the process, that's not a legitimate goal. You know, we need to stop this right now. There's other ways that we can address these issues. There's other ways that we can hold people accountable that are not institutionalized vengeance. And so let's forget, we're not going to be able to tinker with this thing. This thing is broken. This is broken, and we must abandon it now and imagine something altogether different.
So if you had to do it all over again, what would you do different?
I probably would have gone to the prison sooner, because I think that is where my, you know, to use these religious words, that's where my conversion started. And that is where I kind of found my salvation. And so I would not have waited until I was 30 to visit a prison. And I would encourage, and I do, I encourage anyone who's read my book or listened to me talk, to go to prisons. Because I really feel like, you know, that's if we're going to, you know, get back to Christianity, that Jesus talks in Matthew 25, that, you know, what separates the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, you know, where the rubber hits the road, you know, going to prisons, being with people who are struggling, because, you know, what we do for those people, we do for Jesus, is what he says. That I think is the location of conversion and salvation. And so that has impacted my life, so profoundly. You know, and if I had done that when I was in college, you know, or law school, maybe I never would have been a prosecutor in the first place. I don't know. But definitely that's where I needed to be. It's where I continue to need to be. You know, I mean, I'll be out there a week from Sunday night. That has been a constant. And so I would say that would be the one thing that I would point to and say, yeah, I should have been doing that much sooner than I did.
So you're in the prison, you're teaching, and you're going through this transformation. And the name Centauri Brown come across that petition. Did you realize that that was one of your students?
So I had worked on Centoya's case probably a year or maybe more before I actually had her in class. And so at the time, you know, when I'm working on this case, I have no idea who Centauri Denise Brown is. Hers was just another case that was assigned to me to review and to argue. And so I did. I wrote my brief. I went to court. I made the argument, and I forgot about it because this was an appeal. The appeals court takes forever to issue a decision. So, you know, after I finished my work on it, I kind of forgot about it. And then a year or so later, started teaching out at the prison, and had removed it so far from my mind. And again, the possibility of actually having someone in my class whose case I had worked on was so remote that I didn't even really entertain it, that when Centoya showed up on my class roster, I did not recognize her name. It was just there with 14 other names. And so I did not really know who she was for weeks. You know, we were meeting, we were studying, doing our readings, taking quizzes, having good class discussions. I was getting to know her just like I was all the other folks in the class. And she was so bright, such a fantastic student. You know, so glad she was in the class. It was not until the appeals court finally got around to issuing its decision in her case, denying her appeal, that's when I figured out who she was. Because once I received a copy of the court's opinion denying her all relief and affirming her 51-year life sentence, at that point, you know, this is Centoya Brown. This is the Centoya that's in my class, and she's going to get a copy of this opinion and see that I was representing the state in denying her appeal.
Wow. Was that awkward when you went back after that, receiving that decision and petition? How was that moment when you saw her after that in class?
I mean, it was just terrible. You know, it was gut wrenching. You know, I mean, it was like something out of a really bad dream, because she knew me, you know, she knew me as a judicial process instructor and a friend. By that time, I had brought additional books for her to read, and she had, you know, we had a good relationship at that point. And when I showed up the following Wednesday night for class, and I saw her in the hallway because she was waiting for me in the hallway. And I knew when I saw her face, I knew that she had seen the opinion, had seen my name. And she was, and the hurt was written all over her face, you know, because I mean, imagine how you would feel, you know, if you find out that this person that you had established a good relationship with, in the classroom, that this person had, before you even knew that the person, they had sort of betrayed you, you know? So yeah, it was a terrible moment.
I could just imagine. But again, it goes to what I always say. A lot of the times we are in these confinement places and we always ask for second chance. But it goes both ways. It goes both ways. And people always ask me, do I forgive the person that murdered my grandfather? Like, I actually know his daughter. And I say, yeah. And, you know, for some people, they don't understand that. They don't understand. And I always respond like this, Shep, that I ask for forgiveness. Why can I not be good enough to offer it to somebody else? And in this case, this is what I see, man. I see a person that just say, you know what? I was in the wrong line of work. I made up my mind. I want to do something different. And, you know, and sometimes we got to offer that forgiveness. And I don't know if you ever looked at it that way or ever felt that way. Because a lot of time, you know, we equate the criminal justice system with the person that's working for the criminal justice system. You are not the criminal justice system. You're just a person that happened to be working for the system, right? But you are not that system. And this is why for you to transform and say, you know what? That's not what I want to do. I want to do something else. It's acceptable. And I just want to tell you, bro, I just want to tell you, man, from the bottom of my heart, that on behalf of all formerly incarcerated individuals, especially juvenile lifers, those that are still in waiting to come home, we forgive you. And we appreciate everything you are doing today to ensure that those left behind come home and have an opportunity to spend that Christmas that you spoke about earlier with their family and start a new life. We really do. And we don't give flowers to people because a lot of time we look back at the system as it's us against them. In this case, it's not. I am extremely proud and happy to say I could stand next to you. I had stood next to you. I had a conversation with you. And you are the most authentic person I've met coming from that legal field. And I mean that. I mean that because you have no shame in saying, dang, I was hurt when I seen, you know, I did hundreds of petitions. You were just one of them. And you don't have no problem acknowledging that. And to me, that shows humility. That shows that you are really about what you say you are, which is change. And I just want you to know that. Because a lot of time we don't say that to people. And, we, you know, we believe it, but we don't say it to people because we afraid what other people might say. Not me. Not me. I told you from the day I met you, I am extremely happy that you're doing this type of work for the brothers we left behind.
Well, I mean, that means so much. And, I appreciate all of your grace and kindness and hospitality. And that's exactly what I received from Centoya as well. You know, as awful as that moment was, she basically gave me the same message. You know, she said that, she recognized that I was doing a job, based on where I was at the time, and that I had become convinced I needed to leave that job, and that mattered to her, you know, that I had done that. But she also kind of gave me a charge. You know, she said, yes, you know, we all need second chances. We all need, if we're all asking for forgiveness, then we all need to be willing to offer it. But she also sort of delivered a charge. And she said, you know, she recognized, you know, that I knew she was not the person that the media and everything and the courts had made her out to be. But what she said to me was, you know, that I was going to need to go try to find other people who were in similar situations to her, kids who, you know, had dealt with trauma and violence in their lives and who had ended up, you know, in bad situations. And she was like, you know, she wanted me to go try to help those folks. And so again, I do feel like doing the work with the CFSY and meeting people like you, and partnering with people like you to facilitate change and to help people, you know, rethink these things and change their minds. I feel like that's kind of coming full circle, you know? And so again, I'm just so grateful for it, for these opportunities, for getting to know such amazing people. And I hope that whatever state capital I'm in next, or there's another conference at some point, you know, that people can hear that we don't have to be afraid of changing our minds. You know, that is a life-giving exercise, you know, to recognize when we've been wrong, when our justice system has been wrong. You know, President Obama, when he was speaking at Reverend Pinckney's funeral after the terrible church shooting in Charleston, part of his eulogy, he said that justice is us recognizing ourselves in one another. And I think, well, if we can apply that to the justice system, then we won't throw anybody away anymore, because we'll recognize ourselves in one another. And so it's a real honor to be on here with you, and thank you so much for those kind words.
Oh, man, listen, I believe in giving flowers, man. I'm giving you your flowers. I am witness to the work that you're doing with the CFSY. I'm witness to that. I'm part of the organization. And to me, it's like we all have a role. We all have a lane. We all have a personal journey that we must fulfill. And you are fulfilling yours. And I got a couple of more questions, right, that I think some of our listeners would like to see your perspective. In the state of Pennsylvania, former juvenile lifers are still being kept on parole for lifetime. Do you think that former juvenile lifers deserve to be on parole for the rest of their life? When the United States Supreme Court said that it is unconstitutional to keep a person incarcerated for the rest of their life without even looking at their mitigating factors, so how is it possible that that same person could be kept on lifetime parole for life? What is your perspective on that?
You know, I think probably the same spirit that would cause us to throw a child away for 15 or 20 or 30 or 40 years or life without parole, that spirit of vengeance is the same spirit that would cause us to say you need to be on lifetime parole, because there's no other legitimate purpose for it other than, you know what, well, you may be out, but we want to make sure that you never really totally feel free, you know, that you're always having to check in with somebody and get permission before you travel and pay a bunch of unnecessary fees. I think it's strictly that retributive spirit that we just want to keep people sort of suffering. And that is not a legitimate goal of a system that claims to do justice. So again, we're sort of back to, we need to zoom out and analyze the goals of the system. That's not about public safety. That's not about rehabilitation. That's just about punishment. And I just don't think that that is a legitimate goal. When somebody has demonstrated that they pose no threat, they're out doing good work. I mean, that's one thing that I tell these lawmakers that I meet with. You know, when you're talking about former juvenile lifers, it's not just that they're not committing new crimes. You know, we want to talk about the recidivism rate, you know, that when people come home, do they mess up again? Do they go back? And juvenile lifers have the lowest rate of recidivism of any population. It's 1.14%. That's a great thing to talk about, but that's not even the main point, is that they're not committing new crimes. The main point is that they are out there finding these incredibly creative ways to serve their communities and make their communities stronger and safer. And so, you know, if you've got people out there who are doing violence intervention programs in Philly and food ministries in Detroit and restorative justice programs here in Nashville and substance abuse counseling in Chattanooga and reentry specialists out west, I mean, just all of these incredible things, school teachers, you know, and it's like, of course they don't need to be on lifetime parole. We need them to be as free as they can be, because they're the ones who are uniquely qualified to do the work to make their communities safer. So it's completely counterproductive, and the sooner we can end lifetime parole in every state, you know, in the country, the better off we'll be.
People, you're hearing this straight from someone that dedicated years in the system, that's now a major advocate to ensure that our sons, daughters, they went in as youth, come home and have some time to enjoy life. Where can we find your book? Where can people contact you? They want to talk to you, book you. And what's new? What's new for Preston Shipp? What is new for you in your life as you go on with this transformation?
Well, let's see. As far as the book goes, I'm just really, really grateful. Thank you for plugging it, and really grateful to Chalice Press for approaching me about doing this book. It's called Confessions of a Former Prosecutor. The subtitle is Abandoning Vengeance and Embracing True Justice. And you can get it at the Chalice Press website, or you can go to Amazon or Barnes and Noble or just wherever, and just search for Confessions of a Former Prosecutor. So yeah, that has been a lot of fun getting to put all this stuff in writing. It helped me to remember things that I had forgotten that happened, you know, a decade or more ago. It's an exercise I would encourage anyone to take up. I think, you know, there's something about sitting down and trying to think about your life story, because I think so often we're just sort of doing the day by day by day grind, you know, and maybe we miss out on connecting the dots and seeing how one thing leads to the next, you know, and how fortunate we are to have had this journey, you know, the people that have influenced us, you know. So that was a lot of fun getting to put all that together. And I hope people enjoy reading the book. As far as kind of what's next, you know, with work, there's still 22 states that have not abolished life without parole for kids. We're really hoping that Michigan, before the end of the year, we're hoping that Michigan will become the 29th state to abolish life without parole for kids. So anyone in Michigan needs to contact, I would say, the Speaker of the House and the Lieutenant Governor, and let them know this is important. You know, next year, I think we'll probably be working in Wisconsin and some of these southern states, Georgia, North Carolina, New York, Arizona. You know, we'll try to be all over the place trying to end life without parole for kids. But in the midst of all of that, of course, raising kids, I've got teenagers, and my wife and I are, you know, busy trying to, you know, think about what life is like, you know, with older kids. But in the midst of all that, I think, you know, continuing to just be present and be in community with and solidarity with people who are incarcerated, is really sort of my life's work and my calling. The Lifers Club at the Turney Center Prison in West Tennessee is one of the bright spots. You know, you talk about people who are using their experience to serve others. They do fundraisers for kids to make sure kids have good Christmases. They have a mentoring program. So as young guys come into the prison, they get paired with a mentor who can hopefully kind of help them avoid making some mistakes that maybe the old heads made. So I don't know. I think being in close proximity to the folks who are the experts, who are the wise mentors. I've certainly been mentored by so many people that I've met, you know, that the larger society threw away. And so I want to make sure that other people recognize what a treasure we have and how important it is for all of us to give these second chances. You know, it doesn't just affect the person who's serving the sentence. You know, I think about you, I think about others who come home and their voices they're so loud and they're so needed because nobody else can speak to these issues the way that you can and others can. So I want to continue to just be with people like you, you know, and finding ways where I can help continue learning and helping other people learn as well.
And what is your call to action to the listeners?
You know, I'd say, I mean, I'm so happy they're listening to your program. You know, I'm sure that, you know, a lot of minds and hearts have already been changed just by, you know, listening to your voice, you know. So I think, you know, that's wonderful. And I think, you know, to the degree that people are able to read a good book, I read about somebody recently who had been a pretty unapologetic white supremacist. Until somebody gave him a copy of The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. And that book spun him like a top. And so I think sometimes we're just one good book away from a realization, an apocalypse, you know, I mean, like a life-changing revelation could be just one book away. So I would encourage people to try to stretch, you know, and read things that they might be a little afraid of. It might make them a little bit uncomfortable.
I mean, people,
but more than any,
people,
yeah, go ahead.
The book of the year. I'm not even going to say the book of the week. The book of the year, Confessions of a Former Prosecutor. I guarantee you that's the book that would transform your life. And I really mean that. I really mean that.
I appreciate it. I thank you for reading it. I hope others will too. And I hope that it will, if they do read it, I hope that it will be a catalyst for them maybe reaching out to someone. There's so many people who are incarcerated who never get letters and visits, you know, and that's something that we can all be involved with, whether we go to church or just part of a civics organization, just finding ways to kind of stand in those gaps and let people know that they're cared for, that they're not forgotten. So I hope that folks will take those sorts of things seriously, because I think that if we all took an interest in people who are serving these extreme sentences, the extreme sentences would end.
Yes,
because people. I think a lot of this happens because people don't know about it. And once you know about it, you can be part of making sure that it changes.
People, I thank you very much for listening to True Crime, True Story Radio. And I told you this was going to be a dynamic interview, because a lot of time we read about people like Preston in the newspaper, but we never get to talk to them. He's very reachable. Again, thank you for tuning in. You listening to True Crime, True Story. We see you next week.
Tune in every week to True Crime, True Story Network to get today's news on real life true crime.